Good evening. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Once again, I just want to thank everybody who came out tonight, who brought food, brought yourself, brought a newcomer. Thank you. So we're going to pass seven tradition baskets. It states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We have no dues or fees, but that's where you put them. Thank you for laughing at that. The seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. So the Simple Actions group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, out of respect for the speaker, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask those present to please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So normally what we do in this meeting, it's an open big book step study. We have a panel of speakers every week, and we go through the steps. So it takes about 13 weeks for us to go through all 12 steps, and then we'll have a supper and a speaker where we all are tonight. I see a lot of people who I don't normally see at the meeting, so I just wanted to let you know we'll be here at 7 p.m. next Monday night, and we'll be starting off on step one, the doctor's opinion, and you're all invited and encouraged to come back. And we'll have two excellent speakers to talk about the doctor's opinion, and then we'll march through the steps, and we'll do this again in, I think, June is our next one. Somebody check me on that. Sound right? Good enough. So, am I missing anything? So that's the normal format. So at this point, we would normally kick off into that study. But tonight we have a it's a special night. We have a speaker. Mark G. has come all the way from Richmond, Virginia to come and tell his story. And again, just thank you all for coming. And be sure to come up and thank our speaker after the event. I know we're not big on that in the Tidewater area. But in Richmond, if you speak up in Richmond, the entire room will come up and thank you afterwards. But I don't want to take up any more time. Mark, would you come tell us your story?
My name's Mark Griffin. I'm an alcoholic. I am seated with the oldest juvenile delinquents that you've ever amassed around the table.
I know.
And they agree with that. I can always get a feeling for a meeting when you walk in and the people who are kind enough to be out there to greet you do so. And what I was told tonight as I walked in the meeting was, I found out, very important to the dinner. It was, eat the cheesecake. You got to try the cheesecake. So I will confess right here that I ate the cheesecake and it was wonderful. So whoever made it, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. My diabetes doctor will be phoning you sometime next week. If you are new in AA, or just coming back, or just kind of hanging out around the fringes, this is a wonderful way to get your feet wet in AA. People are active and they're happy and they're glad to be here and they're ready to share the message. And that wasn't the way it was for me when I got sober. I'd been a guest of the Tucker Pavilion Nut Hut for about 8 days, and they found a reason to let me go. That was, my insurance wasn't going to pay anymore. So I was pronounced well. It was a Wednesday morning when I left there, and they gave me some instructions on what I needed to do. And what they were was, I needed to go to a meeting that night. I needed to find a sponsor. Amazingly, I took their suggestion to heart. I think it was because sitting around my house after my behavior in the past 2 months was like being in a gallows. So going to a meeting sounded like a great idea. So I went to this meeting, and it was called the Beulah 12 and 12. And that obviously was a step study meeting. And I didn't know anybody there. I didn't know what was going on. I sat down. They explained they were going to talk about the seventh tradition that night, which for a brand new alcoholic is just like a face plant on the table. I was thinking about not drinking for the rest of my life, and they wanted to talk about the seventh tradition. So I sat there as quietly as I could, wondering what's going on. And at the end of that meeting, they offered chips to people. And they offered a white chip, so I got up to go pick up a white chip. And standing at the end of three long tables was this biker. The guy had shoulder-length hair, he's wearing a wife-beater t-shirt, tattoos, hadn't shaved in a week, and he's handing out the chips. And I realized as I get closer to him that he's wearing what perhaps was the last known bottle of High Karate cologne in the United States of America. It was like a force field around him. So I fought my way through it, and I took a chip from him, thinking a handshake would be quite appropriate at this point in my life. And because I was raised a Presbyterian in the no-hug Presbyterian church in Richmond, Virginia. So I stuck my hand out to shake his hand, and he grabbed me and pulled me into an embrace. And I was like eye level with his armpit, and tears are running down my face. People think I'm spiritually moved to pick up this chip, and I was just suffocating. And finally he let me go. It was a catch and release on the newcomer. And I wandered back to my seat, and I sat down, and only God could have inspired this. I turned to the stranger sitting next to me, and I just said to him, "Would be my sponsor." I had no idea what a sponsor was. Nowadays they interrogate you to see if you qualify. I had no idea what being a sponsor was. I didn't know what being a sponsee was. I just know they told me to get one. And this guy looked at me and he said, "Well, I've been sober for a year, so I think we can give it a try if you want." And for 23 years he's been my sponsor, and I see him every Friday night at the Bottom of the Barrel open discussion meeting in Richmond, Virginia. And we still have found new and exciting things about this program as we go forth. It's been an amazing relationship. I finally got even with him and we started playing golf about 2 years ago. And it's wonderful to see the guy that I held on this pedestal has a few minor psychological cracks after the third double bogey. Serenity escapes the cart, and language is different than I expected it to be. It's a pleasure to be here, and I really do thank the folks who put the food out and took care of everything. It was really nice, and I enjoyed everything, and it's great to be in an environment where people are happy and glad to be sober and glad to be in part of recovery. I know this for a fact because part of my service work with my wife is to run a recovery home for women. And I can tell you that usually when they come in, I will ask them at some point in the process what they expect to get from a recovery house. And it's like somebody taped this on the wall of the ladies' room in the detox center. I want to be sober. I want to find a job and support myself. That's what all they say. So I know that they obviously haven't given a great deal of thought to the idea. But they get so emotionally fragile coming into a sobriety house and having to deal with this that I see a lot of women that aren't happy to be in recovery, that need it badly. And an amazing thing happened today. I interviewed a woman, 33 years old, who's obviously had relapsing problems her entire adult life. She sat in front of me with her father and her sister, and for 40 minutes we talked about the recovery house and what the process was and what was expected of her, and I wanted to know what she was willing to do. And when I asked her her recovery date, she said yesterday. Now, the only problem with yesterday is you can't pass a drug test for opiates on 24 hours of rest. And what amazed me more than anything, she was prepared to be told that she couldn't move into the house. She was just trying to find a way to get it out without getting in any kind of trouble. But the look on her parent, her father, and her sister's face when they heard this was, not again, not anymore. And that's the way we parted company, because I had nothing else that I could tell them at that time. The beautiful thing about recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is there doesn't have to be an again or any more times. This program was put together by two men who had a desire to stop drinking then and there, and they did. And even though Bill had a sponsor named Ebby who relapsed regularly, it never became a part of his vocabulary that he had to relapse. Dr. Bob had cravings for alcohol for 2 years after he stopped drinking. It didn't change his commitment to help other people get sober and stay sober. And that's probably what kept him sober. And that's what we count on in this identification process that we go through here. I will tell you just briefly that I was raised in Northwest Iowa, in a small town. Well, there are no big towns in Iowa, period, much less anywhere near the cornfield that I grew up next to. But I can tell you that it was a great place to grow up in the late 50s and early 60s. It was like watching Leave It to Beaver. I mean, it was just, that's the way it was. There wasn't any crime. There wasn't any, we didn't have a poor district in the town or any of that. It was just a nice town to grow up in. And I really, really, truly was blessed with parents that loved me and tried to do the best for me all the time. And they did up until the point where they left this earth. But when I was about 10 years old, we made a drastic change in my lifestyle. 1964, we moved from Esterville, Iowa to Jackson, Mississippi, which was a hotbed of civil unrest at that time. Things were finally changing for the better, but it was taking physical protest to do it. And it was evident everywhere you went. And I had no clue as to what was going on. Absolutely no idea that there ever should be. Why couldn't people go to school with each other? Why couldn't people live together? You know, I was raised in a Presbyterian church environment that said that we should. So I was a little confused about what was going on. And I had this problem, and I found out that as we traveled on and I ended up in Richmond, Virginia, I'm the smallest kid in whatever class I'm in back then. I wore glasses too, which didn't help. But I would always pick a fight with somebody when I got to a new town or a new school bus or whatever, just to let them know that they couldn't pick on me. And inevitably, I got the snot wiped out of me. And I wasn't smart enough to quit doing it. But we ended up in Richmond, Virginia, and that's where I like to call home. And it's where I built up to becoming a good alcoholic. I was learning all the tools of the trade, how to lie, how to manipulate, how to people please, all of the things that make it important for us when we get to areas where life is difficult. That's what we alcoholics do. We find a way to make it go away. And I sat in the first, our class was broken up in 6 weeks periods. The first 6 week report card came out, and there was a note to my parents on there. And then the principal called and said, "We have a problem. Either your son needs glasses or he's a moron." So they took me to the eye doctor, and by God, I needed glasses. I couldn't see anything. And sent me back to school, and the next 6 weeks report card came out, and I was a moron. I didn't do one lick better than I did the previous 6 weeks. And I can tell you it wasn't for lack of being interested in learning, because I had books falling out of my desk, but none of them had anything to do with what they were teaching in school. And that's the way I went through school. I developed a sound relationship with the principal and vice principal. We were basically on a first name basis. My senior year, I was taking Algebra 1 for the third year in a row, still couldn't pass it. And not only that, I couldn't even find people to cheat off of who could get me to pass it. And they were willing to help. They were so tired of seeing me. And after the fifth, sixth period, and it was evident who was going to graduate and who wasn't, the vice principal called me down, and Bill said, "Mark, we've got a problem here. You're not going to graduate. You can't pass Algebra 1. And he said, "You're going to have to go to summer school." And I said, "Bill, I'm going to Europe in July, so if you want me to come back every day next year for one class, I'll do that." And that wasn't an option that he wanted to explore. So he did what alcoholics of my type do. We made a deal. And the deal was, if I could pass the final exam, he'd pass me for the year. And somehow, with the help of friends, in 5 weeks, I learned a year of algebra that for 3 years I had been unable to comprehend. The day of graduation, I took the test, the final exam, passed it by 2 points. The teacher looked more relieved than I did. I didn't know until 3 o'clock that afternoon whether I was graduating or not. I walked up to the podium that night to pick up my diploma, and Bill looked like a deer staring into the headlights. He can't believe that I made it, but he was happy to see me go. And that was typical of my educational career up until my junior year in college. I didn't want to go to college, so when I got back from my little jaunt into Europe, I worked for a year, and then a friend and I took off for California. He's a songwriter. Very successful songwriter, and just retired from Sony Records. But I went out with him. We had a 1970 Ford Maverick, which was possibly the worst made car ever, as we found out when it died in Hollywood Hills. And I had $100 in cash. He had a gas card. But that was enough for us to travel 3,000 miles and find a place to live. We were idiots, but we were having a good time. And we bounced originally from place to place, just trying to keep a roof over our heads and meet people and get a foot in the doorway, which we managed to do, but we had no money. All of my clothes, except for the ones I was wearing, were locked up in a hotel somewhere for not being able to pay the bill. We were staying in a $6 a night hotel room on the Sunset Strip, 5 of us, 1 double bed. It was a horrible, horrible looking environment. One night, I needed to drink. Because since I had been in California at the age of 19, I was drinking daily. It's what I aspired to. I loved alcohol. And we had no money for boats. We had no money for anything. But I had an idea. And I got into the shower with my clothes on, because that's the only way you could wash them. And I figured they'd dry out on my walk up Sunset Boulevard. So I cruise on out to walk up Sunset Boulevard, and I'm in my polyester red bell-bottom pants with my platform suede shoes and a shirt, the collar of which came down to my shoulders. And I walked, and I walked until I got to the Hollywood Hilton Hotel. And I walked in, I walked up to the bar and sat down and just said, "Give me a wild turkey on the rocks." A man named Eric was the bartender that night. I will never forget him and his kindness. And I sat there for a number of hours and drank wild turkey until I'd had all I wanted. And it dawned on me how I'd pay for it. I looked at Eric and I said, "I think I'll put this on my room." And he gave me a guest check, and I wrote down room 235, scribbled my name at the bottom of it, gave him a very generous tip on the card. I don't know who was in 235, but they got a surprise. And I walked out, and that's the way I lived my alcoholic life. I always found a way to get booze when I wanted booze. I always found a way to get drunk when I needed to get drunk. Well, I'd had enough of Los Angeles, came back to Richmond, and at the request of my father, I started to take going to college seriously. I took it so seriously that I majored in philosophy. I kind of guarantee I could never get a job with my education. There's not nobody says must have a philosophy degree to do this in any job I've ever been associated with. But I'm an alcoholic, and what happens to me is I quit just when it looks like I'm going to achieve. Start out like a rocket, fizzle away, and it happened with my educational career. I was a rising senior at Virginia Commonwealth University when I decided to move to New Hampshire and go into business with my oldest brother. I will tell you that to this day, I am still a rising senior at Virginia Commonwealth University and will probably expire my life away in such status. But I did. I wanted to move up to New Hampshire to be with my my oldest brother, and we put a business together doing word processing on a personalized first-class basis for doctors. And it really was the chance for me to get my drinking under full blown. Now, it wasn't hard for me to do that. I will tell you, the first time I got drunk was when I was 17. And what I did was I was working at a restaurant in Richmond, and I got a waiter to buy me a fifth of rum. Went over to my best friend's house. We didn't have any knowledge of drinking. We didn't eat food beforehand. We didn't coat our stomachs with anything. We didn't mix the rum with anything. We just drank it. And I drank a half a fifth of that rum, and it was a wonderful experience. To this instant, I can recall the feeling that I felt when I got drunk that first time. Didn't get in any trouble, didn't do anything too remarkably stupid, didn't break anything, didn't fall down, hurt myself, didn't get sick. Hence, I was going to try and do that again. And I tried to copy that experience in one form or fashion nearly every night from then until I was 39 years old. My best friend got sick as a dog, just tore him to pieces. I had to ask him to quiet down when he was in the bathroom moaning, crying out to God for some sort of relief from his, you know, status. But Bob never had a problem drinking the way I did. And I don't know if that night just kind of set him off a little bit or it just wasn't in him, but I was off and running. And when I got to New Hampshire, I had no one who was responsible with me to say, "Hey, don't you think you're drinking a little too much?" It's not a problem. I learned, for me, the economics of drinking when I was in New Hampshire, what I needed to know to keep the ball rolling. And number one was open a tab at as many bars as you can. So there'll always be one where you can get a drink when you're busted, when you don't have any money, someplace where you know you can go. And number two was kite checks. I don't know if you know what kiting a check is. That's where you write a check for a certain amount that's not in the bank, and you cash it, and you cover yourself, cash it for more, cover yourself, take the difference, go drink on that. The next day you write a check for a little more, cash it, deposit enough to cover yesterday's check, go drinking. Well, it didn't dawn on me in that time frame in the 70s until Jimmy Carter's Bert Lance was his name, who worked with Jimmy Carter, was arrested for check kiting. And it dawned on me to quite inquire as to whether what I was doing was legal or not, and of course, it wasn't. And I was fortunate that no one ever caught me there. I stayed in New Hampshire for as long as my welcome did. My father died. I'm moving back home to help my mother out because she needs someone to be there. The only thing I helped her out of was her liquor cabinet. And we played hide and seek with her liquor cabinet until the day I quit drinking. She'd move it to different rooms in the house and put it in boxes and disguise it and so forth. I found it every day. It wasn't a big deal for an alcoholic to find where the booze is. But I didn't have a lot to offer her except for some maternal love. And if she asked me to do something, I'd do it. But I was unemployed. I had to find a job. I was 27 years old. I had no idea what I was going to do. I wasn't going to teach philosophy, I can guarantee you that. In 1982, if you wanted to buy a car or get a mortgage on your house, the interest rate was 18%. For good credit, heaven knows what you had to pay if you had bad credit. And with that foreknowledge, I became a car salesman. Car lots were just like abandoned cities at that point. Nobody was looking to buy cars. So I went to do it. And the reason why I went to do it is because they had a reasonable amount of freedom that you could have as a salesman. You weren't glued to the desk. You could make it out for happy hour drinks, things of that nature. And I knew that I was in a good place because our salesman of the month for the previous 3 months was on work release from prison for cocaine distribution. So I knew that the occasional snort on my behalf would probably go by unpassed, and that was the truth. I had a guy I shared an office with once who was a retired catcher from the Richmond Braves organization. He played AAA ball. He drank 6 beers in the room once. I didn't see him touch a can, but the trash can was empty when I came in there, and it had 6 beers in it when I left. He was a master. I was just a novice compared to him. But I would work hard. What I would do is I would get up in the morning, and I would go to work, and at lunch I'd go have a couple of beers and a sandwich, go back on the lot. 5 o'clock was happy hour in Richmond where they had 2-for-1 drinks all the time. I'd go have 4 or 5 drinks. They had food. They had to have food out. It was legal that they had to serve some sort of meatballs or something, and I would eat some of those. I'd go back with just enough of a buzz on to make working the night handleable. And some nice couple, hardworking, saving their money, get off work, would come in and get me to breathe bourbon all over them for a couple hours. But I was a good enough salesman that I made a living. And they were happy with me, and they didn't fire me or discipline me or do anything like that. But I got to the point where I needed more money than I was making. Now, 1984, I had the best of the life. I worked for this company. They paid for my gas. They gave me a car. They paid for my insurance. The only thing I had to do was rent a house and pay the utilities, $500 a month. Made 40 grand a year. I drank the rest of it, and I wondered where my money was. I needed more money. Now, most people would think if you were an intelligent, sober person, what we occasionally refer to as normal, I hate that word, believe me. I don't think there's a normal person on the planet. But I would get to the point where I would say, I got to make more money, instead of saying, maybe I should drink a little less. That never occurred to me. And I called on some business acquaintances I had, and I opened up a business as a medical rep, an independent medical rep, covered from Richmond to Boston, as far west as Nashville. And I worked my hind end off to make that go. I developed a special plan, and the plan was a simple one. I would call nurses at hospitals to make appointments. They don't want to see you. They're not going to. But what I did was I would say, I have a product I'm not sure about, and I'd like your opinion on it. Nobody shuts you down when you're kind enough to ask them for their professional opinion about something. So I would sit in my home at my desk with a bottle of bourbon and a shot glass, and I'd make these calls to set up appointments. And I worked for a couple of weeks just setting up appointments. And that set the whole ball rolling. And I met with these clinicians, and they liked my program. They liked the product I had to do, and they would sell it to the doctors for me. And it worked out very well. Once I reached that point, I could throttle back a little bit and drink the way I like to. Start playing golf again in the afternoons. I would go on trips. I'd spend 4 or 5 days in Nashville, have a good time, come back, make a little money. And it seemed to be working well, and I made a critical error. And it really screwed everything up. I decided that the one thing that I needed to have to make my life look right, had a great job, great business card. People could tell a lot that I was doing. I wore a suit every day. But I didn't have a wife. And I decided I needed a wife. So I went to a bar and I picked one out. She drank just like I did. It was true love at first glance. She couldn't drink quite as long as I could, which was nice. Once we were married, we'd drink and she'd pass out, and then I could have 2 or 3 hours of peaceful drinking. And I say that, not, my wife was one of those people, God bless her, who, if you asked her the question, how was your day, would tell you from the time she opened her first eye to the moment we were sitting there, exactly what had happened during the entire day. It was a loaded question. The only person you would rather not ask that to than her was her mother, who trained her. So I looked for a little peace and quiet, and occasionally I would find it by staying in hotels on the road. My drinking got worse. It started to progress. I was a daily drinker and had been for quite a while, but I was getting to the point where it wasn't that I wanted a drink, it's I had to have a drink. My body had to have alcohol to go, to stop my hand from shaking, to give me enough confidence to go stand in front of people. I was starting to break down physically. And she wasn't adding any fun to the process because she started nagging me all the time. And when she would, I would just pack a suitcase. And for me, what would be heaven would be to be sitting in a hotel room hundreds of miles away, ESPN on the TV, bourbon in my hand, cigarette in my hand, nobody calling me on the phone. God forbid we had cell phones back then. I would have been tormented to the point of insanity. But I got to the point where I realized I've got to stop drinking. I've got to try and stop drinking. I can't do this anymore. I was vomiting, just not every day, but a couple times a day. It was like a good morning vomit and then a before the bed vomit. And it was just part of my day. It was like taking a pill. It didn't mean anything to me. It was just part of what I did to stay drinking. So I made a decision. And when you make a decision in my family, the way I grew up, is you decide that you're not going to do something, and then you use what my father used, which was willpower, to not drink anymore. My father was my hero, and he did have willpower. He came up the hard way. He was raised during the Depression, one of 8 kids on a hardscrabble North Carolina Southern Baptist minister. And the people, they paid you with chickens. You didn't make money back then. And he put himself through college to the point where he graduated and World War II came along. And he was a nose gunner and a B-24 bomber, which took more courage than I'll ever have. And he got through all of that. And he had a massive heart attack when I was a little kid. And he worked through that to support us and keep us. And he said, if you want to stop drinking, say you're going to stop, and that'll be it. That's not the kind of alcoholism I've got. I stopped drinking and I said, by willpower, I'm not ever going to drink again. And the next day, I had a grand mal seizure. Scared the dickens out of my wife. She swore I was possessed. She also swore I tried to kill her. I wasn't there for any of that. I was busy banging my head on the floor and chewing the sides of my tongue off. A couple hours later, 2 Chesterfield County cops came in, and I was asleep on the sofa in the living room. And they got my attention. They woke me up. And one of them explained that there was an ambulance here to take me to the hospital. Would I please get into the ambulance? And when 2 guys with guns want you to get into an ambulance, you just get up off the sofa and let them put you on a gurney, and they put you in the ambulance. And I noticed when we were leaving the house, all of my neighbors were lined up around the ambulance to see what was going on. And I'm kind of interested too, because this is all about me. I'm a selfish and self-centered alcoholic. They put me into the ambulance, and my only question at that point was, can we turn the siren on? I've been in ambulances before, but never with the siren on. And I don't know, I think this guy was a little concerned that I'd have another seizure. But he turned the siren on, and off we went to the hospital. I kind of satisfied one of my little bucket lists for drunks. And my GP was a great guy, and he was visiting patients in the hospital, as they did back then. And they paged him and told him that I was in the emergency room. So I'm lying there, kind of. They gave me a shot of Librium, so I wasn't complaining to anybody about what was going on this planet. And he came in to see me. And the first thing he asked me was, how much do you really drink? And for the first time in my life, I told somebody how much I drank. And I got an enormous sense of self-relief from that. Just an incredible sense of freedom for having told somebody else that. But to let you know where my alcoholic brain was, about 10 minutes later, they whisked me away to put my head in a CAT scan to see if there was something in there that caused a seizure. And I remember thinking, maybe I'll have a tumor and I can still drink. And that's what I considered to be my bottom. When I got to the point where I'd rather have a fatal illness than stop drinking alcohol, not knowing it's a fatal illness, I knew I was in trouble. They put me in this hospital, Johnston Willis, and it was nice. A lot of the clinicians there were customers of mine, doctors, customers of mine. So they gave me a nice room up, immediately we started to have problems. I would be found about 1 o'clock in the afternoon in the parking lot trying to bum cigarettes off complete strangers with this pull-around thing they put on you with the open back. Didn't bother me. Might have been a little drafty, but I was getting a smoke from somebody. And we did what alcoholics like me do. We made a deal. And the deal was I could smoke in my bathroom anytime I wanted if I'd just stay in my room. When they came in a couple days later and I was leaning against an oxygen port having a Marlboro, they decided that perhaps this was not the proper environment for me. That night, my now ex-wife came in with this strange-looking little wall-eyed man with glasses, and I swear to God, if I'd seen him in a bar while I was drinking, I'd have said, that's a psychiatrist. But I was not. I was operating under duress. I had no clue as to who he was. And I thought he started to interrogate me and ask me a lot of questions. I wasn't very comfortable with this, what was going on. I felt like I'd lost all control over my life. My wife told me I wasn't coming home. The hospital told me I wasn't staying there. The only place for me was the Tucker Pavilion, which was a detox center. And I had only to say, yes, I'll do that. And I don't remember actually going there, but I ended up there. I woke up in a bed there. And it was a very strange and difficult experience for me going through detox because I wasn't happy. Somebody managed to get it through to my mind that I had to stop drinking forever. And if that won't irritate an alcoholic, I don't know what else was. But I was extremely frustrated. And when I get frustrated, I get sarcastic. And I was invited on a couple of occasions to not participate in my recovery by counselors who had just had enough of me. And I would go back to the smoking room to my chair. I had my chair in there. Don't sit in there, by God. Where Jack and I used to solve the problems of the ward and then the world. And I'd smoke a couple of cigarettes and they'd be through and I'd get out. I didn't have any intention of doing what they said or behaving. I just wanted to be able to smoke and to get the heck out of there. And one day they passed out big books. And apparently they decided that I was well along enough to be safe with a highlighter all my own. Couldn't hurt myself or anybody else. And I read this big book, which is a simple prospect for somebody who reads as much as I do about philosophy. And I highlighted everything that I thought was necessary to know to get out of there if they gave you a test. Wasn't interested in, you know, what the fifth chapter actually said. Just was important to know that I need to line out where it says I'm self-centered. That's apparently a highlighter moment. And a great thing happened. I started reading the stories in back. And I got to a story that was called back then Alcoholic, Dr. Alcoholic and Addict by Paul O. It's known as the acceptance story in the big book. And I read that story, and I'm a kind of a pragmatic sort of thinker, and I got to the point where he talked about having to accept the fact that he was at least in some small fashion an alcoholic. And then he said, if I concentrate on the solution grows. If I concentrate on the problem grows. That's black and white, and it made sense to me. It's the first thing that I'd heard that really made sense to me. And I adopted that as my belief system for the moment on how to deal with this alcohol business. You know, I didn't mean that I wasn't still alcoholic in my behavior. I can even tell you, I was over Easter, I was in this detox, and my wife brought me this big basket of chocolate. I love candy. And in this detox, at least back in those days, they did not let you have any sugar. It was horrible. You know, you'd get a bottle of 2-liter flat Diet Coke that you didn't just wouldn't. I'd rather have water, and I hate water. And you couldn't have any candy or anything like that, except for the nighttime nurse in this place. It was a big old hefty woman, and she was a delight. And I would get out of my bed and leave my room about 11 o'clock, try not to wake my roommate up. And I would meet her at the counter, and we would sneak chocolate to each other from my basket. I had to give her some to get some, but that's what we do. But I got my chocolate fix. That's how I work. That's how I manipulate. That's how I get what I want. But that got me to the point where they kicked me out, and I went to that meeting, and my life started to change. I didn't ask a lot of questions. Back in those days, you could smoke in most meetings, and I was happy to find myself a place comfortably distant from the front of the room and light up a cigarette and listen to what was going on. All I wanted to hear was people who've stopped drinking successfully. I didn't want any bells and whistles. I didn't want any awards. I didn't want any recognition. I just wanted to know somehow how to quietly get on with my life and not drink anymore. Because they told me physically what would happen to me if I drank again. And the message was loud and clear. I was destined for death. I knew I couldn't drink. The problem is, how do I not drink? And bit by bit, it started to seep in. I had this sponsor, and he was the type of sponsor that I needed. I would go up to him and start complaining about how rotten my day was, and he would offer me $5 and just say, go get drunk. That's what you're here for, the wine is. We don't need you here. It's not what it's all about. So I'd sit down and listen to another meeting, and nobody listening to what was wrong with me. And my sponsor apparently didn't care what was wrong with me. But somehow I managed to get better as this process went on. And my sponsor still doesn't tolerate whining all too well. But at least I've learned. I whine to my wife now, and then I go to a meeting. I'm thinking everything is going great in my life. I'm in AA for 2 years. I'm sober. I'm working the steps. I'm going to meetings. I'm sponsoring 2 hard customers who are doing their best to stay sober. I think everything is going perfectly. I've had to leave my business and became a financial advisor for a large investment securities firm. Hated the job. Loved the title. That was my personality all my life. I wanted you to see my business card, and that's all you needed to know about me. I'm thinking everything's going great, and in the space of a week, I find myself going from my home on the golf course, my boat, my truck, my car, my wife, to being alone in an unfinished attic with the TV and my golf clubs. No job, no wife, no nothing. It all just kind of imploded instantly. And it set me for a loop. I had no idea what to do, thinking this is what sobriety's got to offer me. I've lost everything that I worked for to show that I was somebody, something. And it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. Because in that unfinished attic, on my own, I found my way to get on my knees and finally get honest with my God in heaven about who I was and where I was and what I was willing to do. And what I was willing to do was finally surrender everything in my life to God. There wasn't much to surrender. I don't know why he wanted any of it. But he was willing to take it. And I'm grateful to this day that he did. And my life almost instantly started to change because my outlook started to change. And that line that I say so glibly that, yeah, I was selfish and self-centered and that's the root of my problem, finally came home to be the truth to me. That's my problem as an alcoholic. That's my problem in day-to-day life if I'm not working the steps and surrendering my life to God. My selfishness takes over instantly. It's never going to go away, apparently, but I have the proper medicine to keep it at bay. And I started continuing my life in meetings. Life is looking better. This attractive lady invites me to a AA roundup to play in a golf tournament, which I want to do, and had a great time. She beat me playing golf. She ran over my foot with a golf cart. But something strange happened. I found myself sitting in our room that night, 2 o'clock in the morning, we're still talking. Still talking about life and AA and all sorts of things. And it dawned on me, it was the first time in my adult life I'd been in a room with a woman with my clothes on at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we got through that weekend, and I was looking forward to seeing her again, and she was pretty much looking forward to never seeing me again. She didn't want to have a relationship with anybody. Now, I go into my natural mode for attracting women, which is to abduct them, basically. Loot and pillage. But it wasn't going to work this time, because not only did she not want anything to do with me, but her sponsor didn't want anything to do with anybody that would harm her. In fact, her sponsor wrote me a letter when we were going to get married, basically telling me that she would run me down in a parking lot if I ever hurt her. Watching over my shoulder as I leave Kmart for that. But eventually, she stopped kicking me out of her apartment after 45 minutes and started spending a little more time with me. And after a number of months, I convinced her somehow that I was worth spending time with. And we ended up getting married, which was one of the highlights of my life. And it was an AA wedding, and it was a great wedding. We had a great time. Before we got married, I guess we wanted to just do some sightseeing. It was a great way to see how you can live with each other. We went out for a month. We just left Richmond and drove west until we got to Las Vegas, and then we made the trip back. South route out, north route coming in, but we spent 30 days together looking at America, never more than 5 minutes apart from each other. I knew we belonged together. And this October the 5th, we will celebrate 20 years. And it's an absolutely life-changing moment for me. Had to get a job again. I went to work for a drug pharmacy. And was succeeding pretty well with them, and the only problem was I hated it. Retail sales just got so, especially at Christmas time, you felt like you had to carry a bat with you to make it across the store. God forbid you be out of a 49-cent item, some woman was going to terrorize you. And I got to the point where I didn't care. Someone would ask me if we had something, I'd say, let me go check in the stock room. And I'd go back there and have a cigarette and shoot the breeze for a few minutes with the guys. Come back out and say, I'm sorry, man, but we don't have any of those until next Tuesday. Go away now. I obviously wasn't being of service to the customers, the company, or myself. Didn't know what to do. So my wife tells me, try to do something different. Some sage advice from someone. You're not happy, do something different. I said, what? She said, try cooking. Figured I'd give it a whirl. She called a friend of hers who owned some restaurants and asked him if he had any openings for someone who wanted to learn how to cook. And he said, no, but I have a restaurant for sale. And so what I agreed to do was adjust my work schedule so I could work with him from 6 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon at this diner. I did that every day for 30 days. After 30 days, I could cook everything on the menu. I apparently had a natural knack for cooking that I'd never knew about. Said goodbye to the retail world, and went to work cooking food. And Sammy and I had a great time with that restaurant for a number of years. We were open to our friends in AA. A lot of times, in this restaurant that seated 99 people. You'd go in at 9 o'clock in the morning and 50 people would be there in the program, drinking their coffee and just getting their day started. Sammy used to use one of the waitress slots as a get-well job for the young ladies that she's working with who needed a job. And basically, the way it worked was her job was to hire them, my job was to fire them. I didn't come out of the kitchen to play amongst the customers very often, but when I did come out and sit you down, you knew that something wrong was going to happen because I didn't talk to anybody that I needed to unless it was important. I was busy cooking. Don't bother me with that. What, you shot up heroin in the bathroom? Oh, okay. Yeah, call the police, get her taken out. A little Narcon later, they call up and want to know if they still have their job. And so you develop a bit of a thick skin for some of these people. But after a number of years, I've had some health problems, and we had to sell the restaurant. And we moved out to Powhatan County, which is, we live about 45 minutes west of Richmond. And we bought a place with on 11 acres of land, and we just love it out there. In 2009, I had just left my spiritual director's house in Williamsburg and was driving back to Richmond. I got about 20 minutes from Richmond, and things started happening to my body. I started having difficulty breathing. My chest felt like it was caving in. I keep driving because I'm a stubborn alcoholic, and I think if I can get home, I'll feel better. Home's another hour away. Drove past MCV, breathing's a little worse, feel a little worse, keep on going. Past Retreat Hospital, if I can just make it home, I'll feel better, I know I will. Now I'm starting to lose control of my arms and my legs, can't breathe, chest hurts. So I stop at Chippenham Hospital as kind of a concession to whatever's going on, and walk in and just say, I can't breathe, and they immediately took me back and did some blood work for the enzyme tests and so forth. And about 20 minutes later, a cardiologist walked in and said, you have been in the process of having a massive heart attack. I don't know how you made it here alive. I didn't either. I do now. I know that there's a God that takes care of me and has a purpose for me. So they put me in, they had to put an arterial balloon pump in me to keep my heart pumping for about 8 days until it was strong enough to do a quadruple bypass. And it was a rotten 8 days because A, I can't smoke anymore, and B, I have to lay flat on my back. I cannot even turn onto my side for 8 days. I'm just staring at the ceiling, a little bit of the TV. I'm probably annoying the heck out of the nurses. I was not concerned about that at that point. I was too stupid to know how bad off I really was. Until I went in to get this quadruple bypass at 7 in the morning. And that was a wonderful experience because in this ICU, you could have one person in at a time to visit. And the morning that I'm going to have this surgery, my wife has got the room filled with AA people. They're all my relatives, according to her. And they prayed, and it was really, really, it helped me out to get through it. We got into the OR, and just before they put me under, the surgeon says, 95% of the people do this well, but I have to tell you, 5% of the people die. And I'm thinking, thank you a hell of a lot for that. What a way to go under. But apparently I was one of the 95%. AA made sure to bring meetings out to my house, even though my home group is 35 miles from where I live. They had no problem coming out to see me and take care of me. And it really strengthened my faith and belief in this program and the people that are in it who care about us. Beyond the heart attack, life has been good. I'm still active in AA. Of course, my wife and I have a recovery house for women. If you think trying to herd a handful of 22-year-old heroin addicts around is easy, I'll offer you this position for as long as you want to hold it, because it can be quite frustrating, but it's also very enriching. I have photographs on my wall in my den of women who've been sober and clean for over a year, and it really, really is a blessing to see them do so. I get the good and the bad in doing this. I get to see people prosper and do well and have a life, and I see 50-year-old chronic relapsing alcoholic women who can't stop drinking, it seems like, no matter what. try and fail, shame and guilt dragging along wherever they go. And it's just a horrible life, and I don't know how to change it for them, except for to offer them what worked for me. The big book tells me that if I follow this path thoroughly, I'm going to be all right. And if I don't follow the path thoroughly, I've got no reason to expect myself to stay happy or sober. It's that simple for an alcoholic of my type. I don't need a psychiatrist, a counselor, or anything else. I've got the big book and people in my life who have successfully stopped drinking. And that's what I need to stay sober today. I don't need a testimonial from a PhD or some nitwit on TV saying he used to be an addict, but he's not an addict anymore. God, what people will do to make a buck, I tell you. I'm sober today by the grace of God. This pope that they have now is a very interesting guy. And he was I read something he wrote recently about grace being a gift from God. And shame is a grace. I always thought it was a horrible thing. But he said, no, this is the gift from God that opens us up and awakens us to what we need to do. Mm-hmm. And he is truly right about that. So don't feel like you've done something wrong if you feel a little shame about where you've been in your drinking career. Just open your eyes to God so that you can take another step in the right direction. And that's what it did for me. I have a way that I explain what being an alcoholic is all about to me. And I read it in the big book about a guy named Paul. Actually, his name was Saul when it started out. And Saul was not a nice man. Says it in the Bible. He's not a nice guy. He went around persecuting people who believed in this new way, even to the point of stoning them to death. On his way to Damascus, God got his attention, kind of knocked him on his butt, blinded him, and said, "Why are you persecuting me?" And he was converted to a different way of thinking. And God changed his name to Paul. I say he put him in the Witness to Protection program. But he found work for Paul. Paul became a dedicated servant to him, and he did incredibly good things all throughout Asia Minor. Had an incredible relationship with God. And then something happened, and it's only related as he had a thorn in his side. He asked God to remove it, and God said, "No, my grace is sufficient to carry you." Paul's like me. He asked two more times, thinking maybe God got it wrong the first time. And God gave him the same answer two more times. I know today that alcoholism is a thorn in my side. It's going to be there until the day I die. But I also know that his gift of grace and the gift of this program is sufficient to carry me. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Mark. That was amazing. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting, home group members. And the reason we're all here tonight, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? If we could just get your first name.
Corey.
Welcome. Dan, welcome. I can feel it, there's more.
My name's Brian, I'm an alcoholic.
Brian, welcome.
Glad you're here.
Meg,
Meg, welcome. Jen, welcome. Is that it? Feels like one more. There is literature over here on this table. If you can fold it, it's free. There's newcomer packets, a lot of useful information over there. We also have books for sale. We sell them at cost.
Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, come see me after the meeting. I'd be happy to talk to you. I already talked about smokers. After we adjourn, let's stay well. Rick, is Jason here too?
He's working.
Ah. I love you, man. If you smoke, stay away from the doors, okay? That's what I was trying to say. I've got OCD and ADD. All of our all audio meetings are recorded. We have a website called simpleactions.net. You can listen to anything that's been said here. we'll post them. Also, our upcoming meetings are there. And if you want to be on a mailing list to, you know, to hear about things like this in the future, you can sign up on our website, and we'll bother you with very few emails, we promise. Again, could we thank Mark again? Would somebody like to come up and read the last two paragraphs, or technically three, as people like to point out, on page 164?
I will.
Please.
Oh, Dan.
Swear.
All right, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we only know a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past and give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in this fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Thanks, Derek.
Also, just one more housekeeping thing before we close. We're going to need everyone's, not everyone's, but if you can help, it'd be great. What we're going to leave is six round tables down with eight chairs around them. So just six. All these other chairs that are already down, they stay down. But in this middle section, six tables with chairs. Everything else gets put up. The racks are back there. Home group members will help you. But if we could get a hand with that. Is there anything I'm forgetting housekeeping-wise? Yeah, we're going to close in a second. I think that's it. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Let's close in the evening.
Trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.